Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. As we gear up for the general election, we dive into how ballots get counted and how elections get certified.
You think it's gone well, but really, at about 7:30 is when you find out if it has or has not gone as well as you think.
In an effort to lower their carbon footprints, people in our region are building homes out of straw bales.
I personally feel like it's in our DNA to want to be surrounded with materials that we have historically and ancestrally been surrounded by.
Students took a trip to a creek outside of Cheyenne with ties to a 19th century treaty.
Unfortunately, not one treaty has been kept with our people, you know, but we're still here.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. In August of 1889, 5 Western states ratified their constitutions, and they all had something in common. They were unusually progressive and pragmatic for their time, but since then, these states have become some of the most conservative in the country. Sheridan author Samuel Western is a former professor of economics at the University of Wyoming, and he has a new book out called The Spirit of 1889, Restoring the Promise of the Great Plains and the Northern Rockies. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards chatted with him.
I wonder if you can just start by telling me why 1889 was just such an extraordinary year for Western states.
So the wheel was turning for states giving up territoryhood and applying for statehood. And 1889 was sort of the witching hour. And these states suddenly decided that they had a window, and these states had struggled before to become states because they didn't have various qualifications. They didn't have enough population. They didn't have enough assessed valuation. But suddenly they saw there was this push coming. It was quite successful.
What was kind of surprising about all of these constitutions?
Yes, they all wrote their constitutions, and these states would be North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. You know, I think what was surprising was their pragmatism. They were poor, they did not have enough people, and they really put ideology on the back burner and said, how can we create all the necessary players and foundations for statehood? Because of that, they were relatively inclusive.
And what did you find in terms of the unifying values? There was still a certain kind of brand of conservatism, but I wonder if you can talk about what that looked like back then.
Oh, that's a great question, Melody. And it really is at the heart of the book, is that most of the men, and they were all men who were the delegates here, were fairly conservative, which is to say they backed the gold standard, they wanted minimal debt, a lot of the features of sort of classic conservative thought. But again, they were very pragmatic. They had this huge task before them. How could they finance the state? What could they have for revenue streams? It was a unique combination of values of safety and security and tradition mixed with a sense of adventure and open-mindedness. Until you can start to see the cracks were showing by the 1970s and 80s.
You know, we sort of get thrown in these days as a conservative, very red state, that we are sort of the same as a lot of southern states in our values and in our conservatism. But you seem to take issue with that. You're saying that, you know, we come from very different roots.
We do. We come from very different roots. We come from it socially, economically. You know, I think I made the point that the South was connected to Europe through trade, through indigo, through slaves, through cotton, through rum, through rice. We had none of those connections. People came out here, you know, they were generally, especially in Wyoming, they were poor. So a pragmatism and a sense of the common weal was quite unique to the 89ers. How did Elwood Mead, who was then an engineer at Agriculture University, it was called, CSU now, how did he get his water system written in the Constitution? That was radical. It was really something else to make the concept that water goes with the land. You can't separate the water from the land. But that was such an egalitarian concept.
And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how we have veered away from kind of those original values that we are founded upon. What's changed and why?
I think it starts in a place that might strike you as odd. I think it starts at our Permanent Wyoming Trust Fund, that we have a sovereign fund worth $10 billion, now over $10 billion, which the legislature gets, what, $450 million in interest every year? Because we don't have to worry about paying our bills, we worry about other things. I call it, we have a moat of money around Wyoming that protects us. We don't have to change. We don't have to accommodate. And it has made us a magnet for people that want to come here and say, well, we're conservative. We don't want to change. There were a number of things that I think happened. The 1980s and what happened both to oil and gas, to what happened to agriculture. And it introduced a real bitterness. The 80s, late 70s and 80s really stuck in people's craw, and it didn't go away. And what it did is it opened up the lens for people who were generally of a libertarian bent, you know, like abortion. People just didn't talk about that, you know, things like that. Banning books and, you know, it was just like, no, that's your own business. And yet Wyoming and North Dakota, which also has a permanent fund, a lot of the bills got paid. And so it was a petri dish, if you will, for movement conservatism to grow, which is much more inclined to go to social issues.
You mention in the book how you feel that former President Trump represents the antithesis of a lot of these Western values. I wonder if you could explore how his leadership is steering us away from our core values.
Yeah, and I think the central one is a pluralistic society in which no person is above the law. And Trump is an authoritarian. Love him or hate him, he is an authoritarian person. Authoritarianism is a value, and we have never embraced that. And that is probably my greatest worry, is that we, I think, are a relatively pluralistic, inclusive society, and Trump is an authoritarian, exclusive narrative. And I think that is in direct contrast to the values in our Constitution.
What do you think that those central values might be, and are they still something that can bring us together, that there is a commitment to some of those central values that we did install in our Constitution?
I worry about there is a element of the conservative party in this country that does not favor public education. We in Wyoming in particular, but North Dakota, we are over the top about public education. I think another central value is public lands. Man, I just think that is so baked into the identity of Wyoming, is access, public lands and access to them. The third one is, for all these states, not so much Idaho, is a reverence for agriculture. For Wyoming, it's stock growing. And for the Dakotas, it's row crops. In Montana, it's both. Now, the agriculture is changing so fast. It's just, and it's leaving so many people behind. And I don't know how that's going to play out. It's just one big experiment. I wrote the book because I hope we don't lose these values that are so central.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Wyoming author Samuel Western about his new book, The Spirit of 1889, Restoring the Promise of the Great Plains and the Northern Rockies. In places with some of the harshest winter conditions in the lower 48, people are building houses out of straw bales. The alternative material is a way to lower carbon footprints and is surprisingly resilient, Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports.
At the end of a dirt driveway at the top of a sagebrush-covered hill, a dark green two-story house stands tall. The home in Pinedale, Wyoming looks pretty normal at first glance, but to owner Doug Ralstab,
this is a living house. When you go through it, it just seems alive.
The retired geologist stands in the entranceway pointing out the features. And on closer inspection, it's clear he's right. The walls are kind of rounded and wavy.
If you look at all the curves that are built into the window wells and places, it's got its own feeling to them, you know? It's just not squared off and flat.
Ralstab and his family built their home in the early 2000s. They wanted something more eco-friendly than your standard house with synthetic insulation. So they got straw bales from a barley farmer in Idaho and stacked them high like Legos atop a foundation, supporting it with wood posts and beams and sealing it in with lime-based plaster to prevent decomposition.
This house is so sealed with plaster, you can't break the plaster off with a claw hammer.
The main benefit of straw is it's a renewable insulation source. Winters in Wyoming are known for being long and snowy, yet Ralstab says this house has kept him warm, since straw has a similar R value to fiberglass, and it hardly needed any maintenance for almost 20 years.
I was so amazed by how well it has held up.
Architect and straw building expert Lindsay Love helped with some recent repairs. There were little bits of water damage and some cracks in the plaster. But one benefit of repairing straw, all of the materials can be reused or decomposed.
There's no trash. There's no waste.
This style of building was born in the Midwest in the late 1800s, a way to reuse an agricultural byproduct. But by the 1940s, mass-produced cement, spray foam, and fiberglass had taken over. Now, Love says people in this part of the country are more aware of the environmental costs of those materials.
People come here seeking a connection to nature. I personally feel like it's in our DNA to want to be surrounded with materials that we have historically and ancestrally been surrounded by.
Straw comes in at about the same price as conventional materials, but working with it can be tricky. You've got to make sure it's done right to keep moisture away, and not many architects and construction workers know how. So homeowners often do a lot of the work themselves.
A lot of times building with more natural materials is more approachable, so it's easier for homeowners to want to take on some of that sweat equity.
Love is currently launching a training program in eastern Idaho. 8 low-income households will learn to build their own townhomes out of straw. Those work hours will go toward buying the home. Love sees it as a way to tackle the massive housing crisis and get more people to go into the natural building field, like Will Haywood, who's currently finishing his own straw bale place in Victor, Idaho. He's chosen a more conventional look than the one in Pinedale.
The only way you can tell now that it's straw bale is the thickness of the walls here.
Haywood has worked in construction for over a decade. He got tired of filling dumpsters with plastic on the job site and wanted to do things differently. Now that he knows how to build with straw, he hopes to help others do the same. One possibility is starting a company that makes straw building panels.
You know, we're putting more time and energy into sustainable materials and supporting architects or builders that want to try to dive into that.
But first, he needs to finish his own straw bale house. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Victor, Idaho.
Up next, we join in on a trip to a place with special significance to Native people. This is Open Spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Wyoming Public Media will carry live coverage of the 2024 election. Tune in for state and national results and analysis, or follow along online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Until then, if you have any questions on voting and election security, check out our election FAQ on the homepage.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Horse Creek is the last free-flowing groundwater stream in Laramie County. That means it's fed by an underground aquifer rather than snowmelt. Its waters also weave through the history of the area. Students from two high schools on the Wind River Reservation and the University of Wyoming College of Law took a trip there. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman tagged along.
A group of students hike up a steep, rocky hill, huffing and puffing. At the top, they look down at Horse Creek, meandering through Cattail Ranch, northeast of Cheyenne. Beyond the valley, yellow prairie grass waves in the wind as far as the eye can see. Sandra Ironcloud is Northern Arapaho and teaches at Wyoming Indian High School.
We grew up knowing that this was part of our traditional homeland, from oral traditions from our grandparents and our parents. Unfortunately, not one treaty has been kept with our people, you know, so. But we're still here.
One of those treaties is tied to where they're standing.
The 1851 treaty, named after that creek right there, Horse Creek Treaty.
That's University of Wyoming Law School professor Jason Robison. The treaty involved the U.S. government and a big group of Plains tribes, including the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Sioux nations. It defined their territories and was negotiated as settlers moved west in the 19th century.
The original place where they were supposed to negotiate the deal was Fort Laramie, near the confluence of the North Platte and the Laramie River.
But more than 10,000 people showed up, and there wasn't enough room at the fort.
So what'd they do? They moved it 30 miles downstream along Horse Creek.
The treaty was ultimately signed at the confluence of Horse Creek and the North Platte River, right over the border in what is now Nebraska.
The tribal territory that it carved up as a shared territory for the Cheyenne and Arapaho is what we're standing on right now.
That territory was drastically reduced by another treaty about 20 years later. The Northern Arapaho tribe never received their own land and ended up on the Wind River Reservation with the Eastern Shoshone tribe. Sandra Ironcloud says those treaty failures are still very much alive for her.
My history, my life is based upon the sacrifices our people made, which was giving up this land to be put on the reservations.
She's with the school's traditional club and has been teaching since 1985.
To be able to come back here and to connect my students, to be able to come connect, to walk where our ancestors were, it means a lot.
Ironcloud and her students were invited here by rancher and water attorney Reba Epler. The goal was to acknowledge their connection to the land and highlight the importance of groundwater management.
When you look this way, you can see there's a ton of trees and there's a ton of cattails and there's a ton of willows.
A fence cuts the valley in half, separating a lush riparian zone from a not-so-lush part of Horse Creek, owned by another rancher.
I don't want to harsh on this rancher because everybody can change. But the water is so much hotter there. There's nothing to keep it cool. It's evaporating like crazy.
The difference is whether or not cattle graze there in the summer. Epler has been working with a group of ranchers to protect the area from a groundwater extraction proposal and increase the health of the local creeks and streams.
When you look over this way, there is none. And that is because of the management of the land.
The students spend time exploring Horse Creek, splashing in the water and tossing cattails at each other. Then, they hop in a bus and drive down dirt roads to Lodgepole Creek, just outside of the small town of Hillsdale.
The creek used to be extremely different because there was water all the time.
That's Reba Epler's dad, Casey, who grew up in the area. The water's not completely dried up, but it's nothing like the lush green part of Horse Creek.
A combination of drought, excessive groundwater pumping, housing development west of us led to this.
Sandra Ironcloud's granddaughter, JC, says there's a lot to be worried about when it comes to water.
Water pollution and drought and all that kind of stuff. And like they said, water pumping and oil pipelines also.
She's Northern Arapaho in Oglala, Lakota, and her parents went to the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline protests in 2016.
It was a really big thing, and it still is a big thing too. And it should be kept as a big thing because it's like, you know, that should be our main worry right now, is like keeping our water clean and healthy for our future.
And that's what brings this group of people together, a passion for keeping water in the West flowing. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman from Horse Creek and Lodgepole Creek.
We the People is partly a high school class and partly a nationwide civics competition, like a model United Nations club, but for constitutional law and history. A PBS documentary followed a few high school teams, including one out of Cheyenne. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger talked with Erin Lint, a social studies teacher at Cheyenne South, and her former student, Elias Wallace, to understand the competition and what American youth gained from it.
Let's start with We the People. Can you both talk about what the class is, what you learned from it as well?
Basically, learning about your like civic virtues and civic education. So your amendments, your rights, little tidbits on court cases, what's in the articles.
We write 18 essays as a class, and then they have to put away their notes and they get 6 minutes of Q&A. It can be anything under the sun relating to their unit or not. So they have to be really well versed in a lot of different content. We've changed it a little bit throughout the years I've done it in Wyoming, but now we do districts. They read one question, the top six teams then get announced that night. Out of all the teams in Wyoming. And then the next day they do state, where they ask the other two remaining questions that kids have prepared for. And then they announce who will be going to nationals, essentially.
And the whole point of the class, at least what Miss Lint was trying to teach, was for us to form our own opinions on our own without like having someone make it for us. It was teaching us to think more critically about the world around us and be able to make those informed decisions about our political ideologies moving forward.
You've since graduated, and as mentioned in the PBS documentary, you've gone on to join the United States Air Force. But if you can flash back for a moment, can you tell us what it was like from a student perspective?
That class felt like family.
Yeah.
Why didn't the skeleton go to the dance?
Why?
He had no body to.
He didn't have the guts to do it.
The guts.
Why did the cookie go to the doctor?
Yeah.
Because he's feeling crummy.
All right. So let's
do your quiz.
It felt like everyone was there, and like, you know, family fights sometimes, and there was that family squabble, but in the end, it felt like family. Everyone there was there together because they wanted to be there. And Lint was the reason for that, because she tried to like connect with you on that level of like, hey, I'm your friend, I'm your buddy, I'm your teacher too, but at the very most, I'm your peer, and I'm here to teach you about civic education. She treated us like adults.
The first thing I want you guys to talk about: do you want a captain? If so, maybe who would be your person? What do you guys think?
I feel like we don't need a team captain.
Okay, we were just talking
democracy.
About that,
like, I heard
yeah. On the squabbles, how did you handle the more controversial topics, the competing ideologies that might have occurred between two students in a politics-heavy classroom?
So people may hear like someone else's opinion and think, oh, wow, they must like absolutely oppose mine and never want to think of mine, and they're on the opposite side. Now I hate them. It was more like, hey, we're taking it on the chin. We're listening to what they have to say. They're listening to what we have to say.
It's tough because we talk about everything under the sun essentially when we're talking about government. And so like last year, our unit five had a book banning question. And that's like a hot topic, I think, in lots of school districts throughout the nation. And so I had a little bit of nervousness about it, but my kids can't tell you my political ideology in class because I can argue either side and I don't want them to be able to tell where I align. But I'm also, I think, a little bit maybe ballsy when it comes to things like when we had the book banning question. We do have some members, I think, of our school district who are known to be against students having open access to library materials, maybe is the best way to say that. And so instead of shying away from it when we had the book banning question, I invited those members to be judges. One, because I want my kids to be challenged in what they argued. I let them argue whatever they wanted. I didn't dictate it. But then I also wanted to challenge the members of the school board to listen to what the kids had to say. And so my principal found out about it. They were a little bit concerned. They were like, oh my gosh, you're going to lose your job. But I think that it was a moment of maybe, I don't think it changed anybody's mind on any way, shape, or form, but maybe we created a little bit of empathy there on why kids feel the way that they feel, and then using constitutional law to back it up. And it was cool, it was powerful. So
The documentary draws a contrast between Sheridan's national level team, this school that's sending kids to Ivy League colleges, and then Cheyenne's Southside as the underdog school, and with your class kind of being the underdog team.
South High School, I think we have a fairly negative perception in our town. In the state of Wyoming, we're rated like the worst high school.
What are the challenges and hardships that they're talking about when they, or that you and your students are talking about in the documentary when you say underdog?
As we're speaking about resources, the internet just cut out. It's been a huge problem for us this year. I think it's hard to perpetually compete against people when you're already starting at a lower, like as the underdogs, like for example, a lot of my students' parents, maybe they're coming from a single family home, they might have two or three jobs. They're not getting at night like their parents reading to them, or they have to work after school to help their family out economically. That doesn't, when it comes to like spending all this extra time outside of school to devote to something like We the People, I don't have those same luxuries because the reality of the world is there are barriers that a lot of people don't always see.
So in We the People, first question, we have sets of questions that we do. My question set is the first question that we were doing was on gun laws. The part I was on, because we do it as a group of people.
Okay.
It's on gun laws. And
one of the biggest values of this class is the amount of information that they're giving him about our rights. It's things that open my eyes. It's like, dude, I didn't really realize that's how that's really working. And then he has me, like, I'm on the internet, like, was he right? Dude.
As an adult now, how has this class impacted you, or how do you think it might impact you in the long run? Some of the lessons you learned or the information you were given, how might you utilize it moving forward?
Oh yeah, like a lot of the rights that we learned, that's on like tests in the Air Force. So having like the prerequisite of like being in that government class, like I was sitting in a room full of people and they were asking people like, oh, what is your Fifth Amendment right? And that was like right to not self-incrimination. And I was like, ooh, correct. I was like one of the three people that raised their hand. And there was a couple others, like my buddy Wynn, he was immigrating towards the United States. And he had to take a citizenship test. Like he's like, oh, I know this, right? The First Amendment, press, assembly. And there was like a little tidbit that I knew. It was like, oh, it also protects you from this slight on your rights. Because at first people were like, oh, it just doesn't matter. It's like it's a trivial thing. I'm too young to be reading into this stuff anyway. And after that class, people were like, yeah, I think I am gonna like actually go and do my civic virtue because it is important to do that kind of stuff, to go out there and put your opinion out there and vote.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger talking with social studies teacher Erin Lint and her former student Elias Wallace at Cheyenne South. You can watch the PBS documentary Citizen Nation on YouTube for free. Sticking with democracy, we'll dive into Wyoming's election process Up next on Open Spaces, stay with us.
The Modern West is resharing our ranching series, The Great Individualist. This time, we visit a feedlot and a meat processor. Then we talk to the person who revolutionized the meat industry.
See, the thing about big, big is fragile.
Big is fragile. It's part six of our series, The Great Individualist. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. And now to The Road to Cheyenne, our special series tracking the 2024 election. Today, we're talking about what to expect once the polls close at 7 p.m. on November 5th and counties begin to tally the vote. With me today is Wyoming Public Radio's State House reporter Chris Clements and our managing editor, Nikki Woollett. Hey, guys.
Howdy.
Hey, hey.
So I'm excited to pop under the hood of election night proceedings. But first, Chris, any last-minute updates about legislative races around the state?
Yes. For one thing, a number of candidates across the state have dropped out of their races. Like in the case of House District 51 in Sheridan County, former state senator Bruce Burns dropped out. He was an independent running against GOP candidate Lori Bratton. Bratton is endorsed by the Freedom Caucus, so that's one more seat for them.
Okay, and anywhere else?
Candidates also dropped out in races against Representatives Clarence Stivar and Ocean Andrew. Stivar is aligned with the Freedom Caucus. Andrew is Freedom Caucus endorsed. In House District 57, Julie Jarvis is now running unopposed. She beat out Freedom Caucus member Representative Jeanette Ward in a hotly contested race. If you're in either Andrews or Jarvis's district, you'll see their opponent on the ballot since they dropped out after the ballots were printed.
Okay, and so with these dropouts, where does the Freedom Caucus stand with gaining a majority in the House?
Well, heading into the general, they have 26 seats based on official endorsements and aligned votes. As of today, by my calculations, the Freedom Caucus stands to gain as many as 6 seats on Tuesday if all their contested races go their way. That would get them to 32 seats, Camila, which would make a majority. But, you know, it's a fluid situation and we'll find out when lawmakers start casting votes in January.
Great. And we're about to dive into the process behind ballots getting counted and election certification, which is also a fluid process, since some counties do things a little bit differently. So, Chris, you and Nikki both spoke with county clerks in the state. What did they tell you that happens if you're still in line to vote at 7 p.m.?
Well, I asked Fremont County Clerk Julie Fries that.
So if you have long lines at 7 p.m., we instruct our judges to get everybody inside the building and lock the doors so that we have like a total ending area at 7 p.m.
Okay, so in other words, if you're in line at 7, stay in line. But many Wyomingites have actually already voted early or absentee. How's turnout been so far?
Clerks around the state are saying pretty high. As of midday on November 1st, over 100,000 Wyomingites have already voted. That's just 23,000 votes shy of the number of votes in the primary back in August.
Lots of work for election clerks, judges, and volunteers. When can we expect results?
Well, in many counties, we'll have unofficial results within a couple hours. Clerks are trying to hit a 10:30 p.m. deadline on election night. If they don't have unofficial results by then, they need to tell the Secretary of State and explain why. Like maybe a storm's closed roads and they can't get results from a polling site, something like that.
Okay, so we'll get to official results, but let's stay with election night for a minute.
Platte County Clerk Malcolm Irvin told me that these few hours after the polls close are some of the most exciting and terrifying for a county clerk. That's when they start counting ballots.
You think it's gone well, but really at about 7:30 is when you find out if it has or has not gone as well as you think.
Irvin says they prepare for as much as they can, like what to do if there's a fire, what do you do if the roads close. They have increased security this year because of threats around the country. But there's also just stuff that's gonna pop up unexpectedly, and he will have to deal with all of that.
There are two ways ballots are counted depending on how they're cast.
Right. If you vote in person, you are scanning your own ballot through the tabulation machine. This machine is from Election Systems and Software, ESNS. All counties in the state have used them since 2020. And they're not connected to the internet. They kind of look like a giant copy machine. So throughout the day, voters are putting their ballots into these machines. The machines are taking a scanned picture of both sides of the ballot. And as soon as the last person in line at 7 p.m. has voted, those machines start running results. Each machine dumps its numbers onto basically a little USB memory stick, and then election staff escort that little memory drive back to the county's election headquarters.
Those results are then taken from a media stick. It just looks like a USB jump drive, put into what's called ElectionWare, which is some software we have. It's a standalone computer, not connected to the internet in any way. And it then compiles all the results from all of those pieces of equipment into one complete report so that we can send it to the Secretary of State and to the public.
And those memory sticks aren't escorted by just anyone, Camila. They have special couriers.
And the courier by statute can be a law enforcement officer, which I have two of those, and then the rest of them are election judges.
Any registered voter who's not running for office can become an election judge. You just need to get in touch with your county or municipal clerk or the chairperson of your political party. The clerk appoints election judges and runs trainings.
Nikki, you mentioned a second way ballots are counted.
Yes, mailed absentee ballots are a little different. Here's what Converse County Clerk Karen Rimmer says.
We open all of our absentee ballots on the Thursday before the election. We have to notify the Secretary of State of that. We do that with what we call our absentee counting board, which is a bipartisan team of Republicans and Democrats. This is a process that's open to the public.
This process is sorting the absentee ballot envelopes by precinct, opening them up, and then running the ballots through the tabulators. But they won't run any results reports or add those ballots to the final vote count until after the polls close. So then on election night, all these USB drives are coming into each county's election headquarters, and it varies by county how or where the public can watch from here on out.
Once all the results are in, then we post our results on our website, and then we also have to send those results to the Secretary of State's office. Once we send them, they actually make a phone call to us, and they verify what we have sent. So that way, they know that it came from us, and we know that they've received it.
Is there any hand counting of ballots?
In limited cases, like a special district that's voting a ballot with only one item on it, maybe? But generally, no. There's a lot of human eyes and hands reconciling lists of who should have received ballots against who returned ballots, and also parts of auditing ballots after the election is done with human eyes.
There has been no incontrovertible evidence or irrefutable evidence that we've been presented with that our machines used here in Wyoming and specifically Platte County have been corrupted.
The Fremont County clerk told me hand counting doesn't happen for a pretty simple reason.
If you look at ballots, people are creative. They don't follow instructions. So now if you get a ballot that is partially filled in and the machine knows what to read, but we are then supposed to be subjective as humans and decide, was that a vote or was that not?
Okay, so the numbers that clerks get in to the Secretary of State on general election night are not official. When do we get official results?
Counties need to certify results by the Friday after the election, and the state certifies the week after that.
Yeah, the canvassing board at the county level is the election clerk, and also two representatives from different political parties that the clerk appoints. The public can attend canvassing. There's a lot of steps that go into certifying the election results. Here's Karen Rimmer again with Converse County.
And basically, I just give them all of the information, the good, the bad, the ugly. We go through poll books, we go through reports, we go through all of the write-ins that were received and any errors, anything that happened at the election, if there was an incident known at the time of any felons voting or attempting to vote or you know, non-resident alien, that kind of thing. Basically, they had all the information and then they determined if they feel the results of the election are true and accurate based on everything that happened. And then they decide if they want to certify those results or not.
To clarify, when Rimmer is saying they, that's the two representatives from different political parties that are chosen by the clerk. Are they vetted?
Appointed by the clerk. They take an oath of office and are paid just like election judges.
Okay, do they find issues? And if yes, what happens?
Oh, for sure they do. So this year in Sheridan County, the ballot actually has a wrong instruction for a race. It says vote for one, but it should have said vote for two. So that could be deemed a material error by the canvassing board. And if that happens, the election for just that race would need to be redone.
Yeah, and another built-in check that might turn up issues is the post-election ballot audit. It happens within 2 days of the election and is part of the state canvassing board reviews. In the audit, the Secretary of State picks a random representative number of ballots from each county, and then, as Irvin explains...
So we take those ballot images and we compare it to what's called the cast vote record. What that cast vote record is doing is saying, I saw a vote for Nikki in this race, and then... You look at the ballot, sure enough, that's a vote for Nikki. I saw a vote for Malcolm. Sure enough, that's a vote for Malcolm. And what we've experienced, and this is true with my colleagues, is every time we've done this, we have had no indication. We haven't had a single instance where the equipment tabulated other than how the voter intended for their vote to be cast.
Got it. But if people are still worried, who can request a recount?
A candidate at their expense, though they get reimbursed if the recount changes the winner.
A recount would also happen automatically if the winner only wins by 1% of votes.
And in Fremont County, the clerk there told me she wouldn't be surprised to see recounts happen this year. She has 8 school districts that have races for their boards. And with a ton of candidates running, they're getting pretty controversial.
Okay, so the county's certified the election. Are these results official yet?
Not quite. The state canvassing board also needs to meet. That happens by the Wednesday the week after the election.
So the state canvassing board includes Secretary of State, Governor, State Treasurer, and State Auditor. They review all of the issues leading up to and on Election Day and how they were addressed. They go over tests of voting equipment, voter turnout, post-election audits, recounts, write-in candidates, and all 23 counties' results. The public can attend and comment, and then they certify the election. It takes a couple hours.
All right. And now are Wyoming's results official?
Absolutely.
One of the big concerns I've heard this election cycle is about non-citizens voting. Did the clerks you talk to say if they've seen non-citizens trying to vote this year?
Julie Fries in Fremont County told me that historically, it's been a rare occurrence. She also said it usually amounted to a clerical error. Usually people who recently became a citizen previous to the election just forgot to update their driver's licenses with the DMV.
My recollection was when I notified them that said, hey, when I put you into the WireEd system, it came back that you're a non-citizen. They brought me the paperwork that made them a citizen.
Okay, and going back to the certification of results, can anyone object to that or challenge it?
Yeah, a registered voter in the county can contest results, and that has to happen within 14 days of certification. Platte County Clerk Malcolm Irvin told me that the grounds for a contest are misconduct or material negligence of an election official. That's like if a candidate isn't eligible to hold office, or they bribed a voter or election official, or if illegal votes were cast or legal votes weren't counted.
You know, it can't just be, this doesn't look right to me. I want a deeper investigation. It's got to be a specific allegation. And that's unfortunately something we're not seeing very often. We're hearing large dispersions cast or umbrella concerns, but the specific concern is what we need with data, with proof that something actually happened.
Irvin said a contest like this is very rare in Wyoming. He says the kind of things someone would contest about are usually already known by the time the Canvas Board certifies results.
Interesting. And zooming out for a moment, Chris, you spoke with a member of the Freedom Caucus recently. Did he report any concerns that the caucus has or he has with how the general election is going?
Yeah, I asked Wheatland Representative Jeremy Haroldson about that. He mentioned issues at the national level, but here in Wyoming?
Wyoming's in a lot better place. Our Secretary of State's doing an amazing job. Our county clerks are phenomenal.
Glad to hear things are running smoothly. Thanks, you two. And just a reminder, Election Day is November 5th, and you will need to bring an ID, and you can register to vote at your polling location. Up next, we hear about a test comparing hand counting to machine counting. This is Open Spaces.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Some Wyomingites are pushing for ballots to be hand-counted instead of using the tabulator machines that all 23 counties have used since 2020. That call is particularly strong from a political action committee called Wyoming Election Integrity. So a month before this year's general election, Campbell County Clerk Cindy Lovelace hosted the group to run a test trial to estimate the time, manpower, and cost. Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette spoke to Lovelace about the test.
What prompted you to want to run a test trial of hand counting?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about hand counting ballots locally here in our county and around the state. So I just felt it was important to gather some data on the process and to look at the potential time, potential cost of hand counting ballots. That way, if it did go to legislation, we had some actual facts and data that the legislators could use.
Who was invited to participate in this exercise and who showed up?
So I invited a representative of the Wyoming Election Integrity Group to facilitate the test trial and to use their tabulation system that they've been trained on. So we held it on October 4th in the chambers in Campbell County. There were 43 people who participated. 40 of those were hand counters, 3 were facilitators. 29 of those people were from Campbell County and 14 were from other counties in the state.
Can you kind of talk me through what did you do? What kind of scenario did you set up? What instructions did they get? And then what were they doing?
So we prepared 1,110 sample ballots for the test trial. So that consisted of 30 ballots from each of our 37 precincts in Campbell County. So of those 30 ballots, we had 20 ballots that represented votes cast on Election Day. We had 5 ballots that represented mail-in ballots and 5 ballots that represented early voting ballots. So we started the test by sorting the absentee ballots and getting those prepared for the count because those come in at a different time. The actual hand count process began about 9:45. So there were 10 teams of 4, and each team of 4 was given 2 precincts to count. So each precinct consisted of 30 ballots. So that was 60 ballots total for each team of 4. They have a tabulation sheet, and they have a process that they were instructed by the facilitators on how the tabulation works, and they were given some pre-prepared binders that gave them all the materials that they needed. So using their process, they tabulated their ballots. So they have one person who calls out the name on the ballot. They have 2 people that are marking the tabulation sheets, and then one other person who oversees.
How long did it take them to finish the count?
We started at 9:45. They each took a break for lunch. So the facilitator stopped the test at 5:00. By that time, we had 4 of the 10 teams that had completed their count of 60 ballots. So we had a total of 240 ballots that were completed out of the 1,110. I calculated the total count time at approximately 6.75 hours.
How does that compare to like primary night this year when you were using the tabulation machines?
So So our results are tabulated in real time on the election voting machines. When the polls are closed, then the election judges, then they close down the voting machine and provide us with the results from each of the machines. And then it's just a matter of uploading those results and providing those to the Secretary of State. So we have to have those into the Secretary of State by 10:30 p.m. on night of election. And the polls close at 7.
After running this hand count scenario, what are kind of your big takeaways or learnings?
I calculated some results from what we found during that test trial, and I used some data from the last presidential election. In that election in 2020, we had 19,735 ballots cast. This general election, we have 23 races on each of our ballots on the average. So I use those numbers to calculate an estimated number of people needed, our amount of time it would take to count the ballots. So just given a timeline of 4 hours, and this number comes from the Wyoming Election Integrity Group. So we'd be looking at, you know, close to 20,000 ballots. The number of people that it would take on the minimum would be around 550 people, and it could be up to 1,000 or more. So getting that number of people trained and in place to count the ballots would be one of the first challenges that we'd see. The second challenge would be, when would we start the count? Would we bring in new staff? What would our staffing hours and overtime look like? Because by that time, when the polls are closed, my staff's been for 18 to 20 hours already. So what would that look like if then we began hand counting ballots? The other big question I have that we weren't able to really address during the test trial is how we would test the accuracy of the hand count process. Right now, we have a procedure to test our voting machines for accuracy, but what would that accuracy test look like for the hand count process? When you have human discretion, fatigue, human error, all of those elements that could be involved in determining the election day results, how would we test that accuracy?
That's a great question. How do you do the audit?
Well, you know, one person could look at a mark on a ballot and count it as a vote, where another person may not count it as a vote. Right now, the machine has specific criteria on what it counts and what it does not count. It will reject ballots that have an overvote for a race. In a hand count situation, that voter would not be aware that they had overvoted and that their vote wouldn't count for that race. So there are some checks and balances right now with the machines to give the voter an opportunity to correct their ballot, where in a hand count situation, the voter would not have that opportunity.
I'm curious what you heard from participants after the test trial.
Some of the people that I talked to were surprised on how easy it is to make a mistake, even on their tally sheet. So you really have to be very focused through the entire process without any distractions. But majority of them who participated said that they would be willing to do it again, and they were still in favor of hand counting.
That was Campbell County Clerk Cindy Lovelace talking about a test trial of hand counting ballots that she hosted last month. A member of Wyoming Election Integrity says Lovelace's estimates are inflated. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, today's audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer. And a thank you to our social media manager, Cody Hume. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.